Castle Rock Entertainment and Stephen King invite you to visit Castle Rock, Maine, a quiet little town whose population has just increased by one.
Do you believe in the devil, Father?
I guess I have to. We can't have one without the other.
What's he look like? What the hell does he look like?
May I take this opportunity to welcome you to Castle Rock on the good Lord's behalf?
Why not?
So where are you from?
Ohio. I've been in this business a long time, and I've learned the pleasure of offering my customers what they really need.
He came here to destroy us.
Oh, you wussy.
There have been two murders and an attempted suicide in this quiet little town, and Mr. Leland Garner's at the bottom of it.
You are disgusting. I like that in a person.
Everybody that's got it coming is going to get it now.
The young carpenter from Nazareth? I knew him well. Promising young man, but he died badly.
Welcome to Host Choice, where we hosts finally get to choose what we watch. Today we're discussing another Max von Sydow film, 1991's Needful Things. I'm your host, and all I ever wanted was a nice place to live and grow. My co-host is Guy, an actual old man from Akron, Ohio, who enjoys an occasional practical joke.
Yeah. Hooking the people together like fuse boxes.
How's the weather there?
Oh, today it's cold as heck. It's in the 40s, you know, and it, well, that's Northeast Ohio, you know. One day it's 70, the next day it's 40. That's all right.
It kind of cracked me up that, you know, the key character in this comes from, or allegedly comes from Akron, Ohio, because I'd never heard of Akron, I think, before. you know, got to know you.
Yeah.
It's a pretty small place for people to be calling Akron.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's somewhat well-known because, you know, it's the rubber city back in the its heyday. It had all the tire companies were here, presumably so that one tire company would start here and then another one would move in so they could poach the employees who left the other companies. But, it's a nice little town as cities go. I'm not really a city boy at heart, I don't think, but, it's good enough. I like it. And in Needful Things, we'll actually get to hear Ed Harris pronounce it with a classical Greek pronunciation of Akron.
I do have to say that, you know, having now about a year and a half or something lived in Ohio, the number of times I'm listening to some news item or whatever, and it's, oh, this crime happened in Ohio, and I'm like, oh, God. So what is your, before I get to the movie, what's your history with Stephen King?
Ah, well, I started reading him back, I think in the 70s. The Shining was one of the earliest books of his I read, and The Stand. My mom, when we lived up in Michigan for 4 years, so that would have been late 70s, early 80s, my mom had read The Stand, and she had a friend who lived around the corner, we lived in a soybean farming type area, so around the corner was like a mile away. My mom and her friend would discuss little things they found funny in it, you know, little. Stephen King puts a lot of amusing one-liners in his books, typically. So they got a kick out of it. And eventually, I was persuaded to read some of his stuff. You know, there's Carrie, Salem's Lot, The Shining, The Stand, you know, all his early stuff. And I kept up with it. I've read probably, well, he's published several things in recent years that I haven't read, but I've probably read a good 2/3 of his output, at least, I'd guess. And I enjoy him. He's a terrific storyteller, I think. Sometimes he doesn't stick the endings, you know, because the way he works is kind of improvisational, which means he isn't always deliberately working toward a certain goal of the end of the story. You know, he's just sort of seeing what he unearths. And he's just, in addition to telling fun stories, he has a good prose style. It's very clear and concise. He gets his point across without being all florid and wasting a bunch of your time. He still writes huge books, but at least he's not deliberately wasting your time. You know, he's always saying something new. So I enjoy his writing. I do have some differences with him as far as, political philosophy, but if I only enjoyed people that I agreed with 100%, I'd have one person I enjoyed.
I remember Carrie was a big deal because of the movie when we were young, and I recall him telling a story. I think I read a book of his on writing a while, years ago, and it was sort of part memoir and part, teaching writing.
Yeah.
I remember him saying that he didn't like the Carrie book and he threw it away. And like his wife apparently got it out of the garbage and that like started his whole career.
Yeah. That's if you're going to get married, that's the kind of wife you need.
and he's had, for a horror writer, he's had his amount of things to handle. Right. He got hit by a truck.
Yeah, I think it was a van. He was just walking along the roadside, and the guy was drunk and did some serious damage to him.
Yeah, that kind of thing where they sort of have to put your body back together. I mean, probably never get free of pain and all that. And I don't know where it was related, but also, he realized at some point he was an alcoholic, and apparently that was causing problems, and he had to get over it. According to Wikipedia, this is the first book, Needful Things is the first thing he wrote after going through alcohol rehabilitation.
Oh, okay.
So, and I think also, because I think he lives in a, not unlike Akron, a kind of, quiet place. And
it used to be Bangor, Maine. I don't know if he's still there or not.
Yeah, and I think, one of the things that's easy when you're a full-time writer, kind of out, without not living like in New York or something, is it's easy to just sort of fall into the bottle.
Yeah, I think that's easy to do pretty much anywhere. if you're prone to such things. And I certainly have my share. I'm already in my second drink of the evening, but it is 7 p.m. here, so that's fair, I think.
Got to loosen up for the podcast.
Yeah.
Let's see. And also in terms of his history, I remember, I think one of the first books of his I read was Firestarter, which enjoyed. He did, The Shining, I saw, I don't think I ever read the book, but I, saw the film. And of course, there's an interesting thing there too, because he really didn't like what Kubrick did with The Shining.
Yeah. I saw a quote from him just the other day, actually, where he said he pretty much liked everything Kubrick had done except the adaptation of his own book.
Yeah, and he so disliked it that he eventually did his own version. He directed, like, a TV version, which, nobody's ever talked about.
I did see the TV version, and I thought when I saw it, I thought it was pretty decent, although that was quite some time ago now. But, it was good and much more faithful to the book, of course.
Yeah, and I can understand having a certain vision and being annoyed that someone changes it. But on the other hand, if someone does a film about your book and multiple things about that film become known for decades later, right? Yeah. Here's Johnny, all work and no play, and...
And that really is just a stylish film. I mean, it's really neat. In a lot of ways,
the two girls at the end when he's going along on the little tricycle.
Yeah.
I mean, just there's so, and I haven't seen it in decades, and I can tell you, remember all these scenes and words, so I feel like, maybe at some point you should say, maybe Kubrick kind of knew what he was doing.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's hilarious. I think I've only been to visit you at your place and your new place, a relatively new place, once so far. But it struck me as hilarious that the carpeting in the hallways there, it's a big hotel, basically, hotel/apartment complex. And the carpeting in the hallways is the Overlook Hotel, the famous interlocking hexagons carpet, which I thought was hilarious.
Scenes, too, that just never forget, him talking to the bartender, which actually has some relation to this movie. A little bit, just, the way the bartender is egging on, what's his name? you know, and closing in on the old photograph at the end and seeing that he's in it, you know.
I mean,
I disagree with King. I think it's a pretty effective movie, but you got to, you know, what can you do?
Well, he wrote the book. He deserves his own opinion, I think.
The other movie, and again, I hadn't read too many of his books, but the other movie that really worked for me, and probably in terms of personal horror, so, you know, The Shining is a horror movie. You get thrills or scares or whatever watching, but, you know, then there's the kind of thing you can really feel, right? And Misery... is probably the most effective for me because, you know, that sort of thing has happened to people. You can imagine it where.
Oh, sure.
This author who's, you know, clearly Stephen King crashes his car in the woods in the middle of nowhere. And this woman who's his biggest fan finds him and she turns out to be insane and, you know, handcuffs him to the bed. And then she finds his latest manuscript where he kills her favorite character and she makes him rewrite it, you know? So I think that's a pretty effective one. And the movie was really well done.
Well, I'm trying to think if I ever saw the movie. I think maybe I did, but I did read the book at least. And it was pretty good. Yeah. And actually, while it's in my mind, I wanted to mention this movie, Needful Things, is somewhat like The Shining in the sense that it is not a completely faithful adaptation of the book. It uses a lot of stuff from the book, but it also does go its own way. And some people were not happy about that. I thought what the movie did was interesting in its own right, so I didn't mind as much as many people did, I think. But it is. This is not a faithful Stephen King adaptation. It's a partly faithful adaptation.
Okay. Well, let's jump into the actual film itself. As is true of all of these small town films, you know, it starts out with a cafe.
Yeah.
You know, I'd made a list of films this reminded me of, and you know. A History of Violence starts out in a cafe and is also a small town one. I guess other ones don't have so much cafe stuff in them, but that one reminded me of.
What?
And that also has Ed Harris, and we had to watch that someday in a very different role.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing that. I think, Back to the Future, you've got that diner where, you know, Biff meets Marty McFly and all that stuff. Yeah. It's a pretty standard locale for a movie.
Right, and I guess there's a storefront that's been empty for a while, and it's now ready to open, and they're kind of curious about what it's all about.
There's soap on the windows.
but the weird thing to me is, so this woman, it's Nettie, right? Or
yeah,
Nettie?
Nettie Cobb.
It seems like she's a little bit simple or something, right? I mean, she just... You know, and she's staring at this store that hasn't opened yet, you know, out the cafe window. And, you know, like you mentioned, she says, oh, they still got soap on the windows. And she says something about, like, this is a bad place or whatever. And I felt like that meant that she was going to shy away from it, right? But that goes away and it has no impact at all. She goes into the store early on in the movie, and so
she's suspicious of it, but her boss Polly sends her over because Nettie makes really good apple pies, and she wants to welcome the newcomer to town. So she gives her a little pep talk and sends her across the way.
Right, and the owner of the new place is Max von Sydow.
Yeah, Leland Gaunt. The proprietor.
Yeah. And he, you know, the movie wastes no time jumping into things, and he wastes no time, right? So we quickly realize that, I mean, it's basically a novelty shop, right?
It's all sorts of antiques and curios, that sort of thing, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I used to, you know, much of my life, and I lived in the Seattle area, and in Seattle, there's a ye olde curiosity shop, right? And there'd be you know, a skeleton on the wall that's a real skeleton and, you know, that kind of stuff. And you never knew what you were going to find. And that's very much what this is. What we quickly realize is that whoever comes in finds something of particular interest to them. And we see it at first with this little boy, the Billy.
Brian Rusk.
Brian, yeah. Okay. And, yeah, we see it first with this boy, Brian, and he's really into baseball, and he's disappointed to discover that the store doesn't have baseball cards. You know, he wants some.
Well, he doesn't know what he's actually, he's going in out of curiosity because the sign on the door says it's open. He doesn't really have anything in mind, but after Gaunt introduces himself, he says, "So what would you like?" And then, you know, he shows him a pair of fancy sneakers and he's like, "No, you don't want that." And, he soon identifies that what Brian would like is an antique baseball card.
Right. And it's of, Mickey Mantle, and
it was Sandy Koufax in the book, but I think they changed it because people would recognize Mickey Mantle's name better.
Right. And Gaunt's like, "Oh, I think I have something in the basement." And it turns out, not only does he have a Mickey Mantle card, but it is signed to the name Brian.
To my good friend Brian.
Right. It's very convenient. And here we see right up front how he works, right? Because he says this is probably worth $500, and Brian has 95 cents. so he makes a deal with him that it'll cost 95 cents, and he just has to do something for Gaunt. And
the other part is a deed.
Yeah. And that's kind of the whole movie is, you know, whatever people want, he gets them to do something for it. And so it turns out he wants, I think the first thing is he wants Brian to take bird poop and put it on the sheets of this woman.
Yeah. Wilma is a turkey farmer, so she's got an abundance of turkey crap right there. All he has to do is scoop it up and throw it on the clothesline hanging right nearby.
Right. And she's a very sort of masculine woman, you know, takes no crap. Clearly her husband is sort of, you know, she's the one who wears the pants of the family.
Yeah.
And the thing is, what Gaunt knows is that she's going to assume that it was Natty from the cafe who did it because she and Natty have issues with each other.
Yeah, we've already seen them confront each other once, and they don't have any love lost between them.
Right, so that causes her to go off on Natty, and then, you know, so basically he just sets up these things where he gets someone to do kind of a practical joke, and that plays into somebody's psychology or whatever, and then they assume it's somebody else, and then he gets them to do a practical joke on somebody else, and it's just a whole cycle.
Yeah, as the sheriff puts it later, almost at the end of the movie, almost, he says, you know, he's wiring us up together like fuse boxes, and that's how he works.
Yeah, and it's not like he's never lived here or anything. In fact, it was, we mentioned earlier in the podcast, you know, he claims to be from Akron. Nobody knows him, but he knows about everyone, and he knows their, like, intimate secrets.
Yeah, he has a whole lot of knowledge of things that ordinary people wouldn't have any way of knowing, which the movie suggests, I think, that he's the devil. In fact, there's a lot of jokes about that, you know, like the Baptist minister is going around handing out these stickers and say no to the devil, stuff like that. In the book, it was a little different. It's been quite a while since I read the book, but in the book, he was more of an unidentified demon who'd been doing this for a long time.
Right.
But the movie, when they adapted it, they seem to have changed him to the devil. But he's a very entertaining devil, and some of the things he says later make you wonder, or made me wonder at least, you know, like, or wonder about his motivations, because he says something like, "Not my best work, not by a long shot." You know, so he seems to see it almost as a job, which is
right. Yeah, he makes that very clear at the end. But part of what we see somewhere before then is that the sheriff finds all these newspapers that Gaunt has kept, and, you know, interprets from that basically at all the bad points in history, he was there making it happen. Right?
Yeah. And he took some keepsakes from the front pages.
Yeah. So, you know, the Holocaust, et cetera. And
yeah.
So first of all, I'll say this was another thing that made me feel, reminded me a lot of Halloween 3, because The main bad guy in Halloween 3, it turns out, also has probably been alive for a long time. And at some point, you know.
Oh, yeah, Connell Cochran. Yep.
He remembers things that happened hundreds of years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. The old.
And also
old
does practical jokes. And
oh, yeah. That's his stock and trade. Yep. Novelties.
Yeah.
So actually, there's a lot of similarities now that I think about it. Yeah.
And I would argue that, well, first of all, a couple of things here. One is that, I mean, basically what we described is the movie, right? The movie is just practical joke after practical joke causing people to go after each other. And by the end, the whole town is, you know, basically destroyed with people trying to kill each other.
There's riots, there's explosions, there's and Sheriff Pangborn, Ed Harris, he's continually finding out new clues that make him suspect Gaunt more and more.
Right. And the worst person in town, because a lot of these people would normally just be normal people and maybe, you know, the normal annoyances you have with your neighbors and stuff. And of course, Gaunt has taken them all, you know, up to up to 11 on that. But there is one guy in town who all on his own was that bad, right? I think he's the mayor, isn't he, right?
He's the head selectman, which is the New England equivalent of mayor, I think.
Right. And he has been embezzling, and he's in real trouble, and he's, you know, doing everything he can to deal with that. And he has no problem with killing people or, you know, to get out of things.
He had a paranoid streak we saw even before Gaunt got involved.
Right. So really, I mean, that's why I almost say Gaunt really didn't have to do anything with him, right? I mean, not very much. I did think it was clever that the thing that Gaunt does to him is he gives him a great-looking, old-fashioned, you can't call it a board game, but old-fashioned game.
Mechanical racetrack, like horse racing.
Yeah, and they did a really good job, you know, with the box and the thing. It looks very realistic. And the thing about this horse racing game is you have the actual little metal horses in tracks, right, going around. And I think there were things like this, and there was some way that it would be randomized so that you didn't know which one was going to win, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so Gaunt tells him that there was a person who used this set and became very rich because he would just assign the name of the horses that were playing that day, and whichever one won in the game was the one that was going to win in reality.
Right.
And, you know, this is going to solve all this guy's problems, right? Because he's in debt.
And betting at the track is how he got in debt in the first place.
Yeah. And so he's very excited about it. And later he's so bad that, I mean, Gaunt gets him to, well, first blow up a church with dynamite. And then second, he, in the end, comes out with his whole body wrapped in explosives, and he's going to blow everyone up, right? So that's kind of, I think that's supposed to be sort of the finale for Gaunt, right? He'll sort of take care of everybody left in the town.
And along the way, this character Danforth Keaton, who people call him Buster, and he hates that, but nobody knows why he's called Buster, where of course it's a reference to Buster Keaton, but nobody seems to know where that name came from. They just enjoy calling him Buster behind his back. But he also, he does some other bad things along the way, like he loses his temper with his wife, his paranoia gets the better of him, and one of my favorite exchanges in the movie just for sheer dark morbid humor is, you know, he calls up Gaunt after he's killed her, and he says, I think it's I killed my wife, is that wrong? And Gaunt says, hey, these things happen. Just a lot of stuff like that throughout the movie, and I probably enjoy those kind of little nasty things in, you know, that kind of humor more than many people do, I think. But that's pretty much the tone of the movie throughout. You know, a lot of stuff like that comes up.
Right. I mean, I guess we could just, you know, talk about the ending a bit and then some comments here. But because in the end, when he has Danforth, who's played by J.T. Walsh, who's a great guy, you know, supposed to blow up everybody. In the end, they manage to get it so that he blows up the store, the Needful Things store, with him and Max von Sydow, And then it turns out that Gaunt is not only alive, but his clothes hasn't even been impacted. And, you know, he's when he gives the speech,
still about it wasn't as dapper as ever.
Yeah. So he's kind of screwed up in that the people are still alive and they haven't lost their souls. And he's unhappy about that. But he drives off and then his car disappears. So it's when it's, you know, very, if you had any questions remaining about whether he was some kind of celestial being or not. I would, so first of all, I think they missed a really good opportunity in the end, because at the very end, when he's sort of totally revealing himself, he tells the sheriff, because the sheriff and the woman who runs the cafe are an item, although he sort of got them to split up during the movie by, you know, spreading some lies.
He turned them against each other, although not irrevocably. They didn't get to the point of trying to kill each other.
And he says, oh, in 2048 or something, I'm going to meet your son in this town or whatever. And there were a couple issues I had with that. One is it kind of made it like, well, if you already know everything's going to happen, you know, that makes it a little less suspenseful. But two, one of the things that he did in this at one point was he slept with the sheriff's girlfriend, right? Yeah. The owner.
It's implied, at least. I mean, we see her have a vision of it. We don't know for sure how far things went, but it seems like that happened at one point.
Yeah. And I thought it would have been way better for him to lay the seed that it was his son, that she's going to have his son, right? Because that would have helped screw them up going forward, right?
Ah, yeah.
So I thought there was a lost opportunity there.
That's a good point, yeah. But maybe he's just not a sore loser. You know, he doesn't want to rub anything in.
Right. And I actually think it would have been better if he was like some minor demon rather than the devil or Satan, because his history is doing things like World War II and the Holocaust and all these things. And here he is in this tiny little town doing relatively inconsequential stuff. It would have made it a lot more sense to me if he had been a more minor person doing this.
Yeah, that's fair too. Although, especially since he does have some sort of premonition or some ability to tell the future. Although we don't know what kind of constraints are on that, and I don't know. But certainly, those are valid points. You could argue those are some plot holes or missed opportunities, definitely.
I guess the other thing, I'll go lay out my other complaints and then you can defend
Okay.
But I felt like this would have been perfect as, say, a Twilight Zone episode, right? Because it's just the same thing over and over. And so, halfway through it, it's a 2-hour film. I'm like, okay, well, where are we going here? And it doesn't go anywhere. I mean, it just, you know, yes, people keep getting mad at each other and they descend into all this, but like you know that's all going to happen from the first practically minutes of the film. I think if it had been, you know, just a TV episode length, it actually would have been better. And I'm curious, but I'm not going to watch it. As we know, they did a TV version that was much longer, and there's no way I would watch a longer version.
Well, I'll definitely watch it one of these days if I get the opportunity. Right. I mean, I have it on Blu-ray. I just got to get around to it.
I read that, you know, there is more stuff about the people in the town and everything, but if you're going to have it be longer, I would want some other twists or something.
Yeah, and there are other stories, but I imagine a lot of it is going to be more pranks. And this occurred to me just now because I just happened to be reading about the Saw movies today, and I've only seen one of the Saw movies, and I'd like to see more because they have Shawnee Smith in them, and I love her, but they're just a little too over the top for me. You know, I'm kind of a big old wimp, not from my glory days in the 80s when I watched Faces of Death and all those, but I think the appeal of the Saw movies, now, from what I understand, they're actually pretty intricately intertwined together. There are a lot of plot points that carry over from movie to movie and a lot of twists and turns throughout. So That said, I think a big appeal of the Saw movies for people who can stomach it is that every movie is going to give you a new suite of nasty little experiences to see, you know. Right. So you have to be willing to accept that it's not just the plot that's the draw. It's what specific awful things are people going to have to cope with in this
one. And I haven't seen the Saw movies, but from what I'm aware of, you have things like, oh, the key that you need to, you know, save yourself is in your stomach, right, or whatever, and now you need
to, tuck you know, get it out or whatever. Or something. Yeah.
Well, and I agree, and I think that, but in this movie, it's like, oh, throw apples through these windows, or, you know, like, these are not, you know, these are not exciting pranks for the most part.
Yeah, that's true, although when you see how these things can escalate, I mean, that happens in real life sometimes too.
Yeah,
people have misunderstandings and they blame somebody for some insult or slight that turns out to have nothing to do with the person they thought it was, but everything was set up in a way to make them think that it was like that. So
a movie I like a lot, I might have told you about this before, a movie by Barry Levinson called Avalon.
Right. Now, which I remember you mentioning that to me before.
Yeah, it's about these immigrant families, and it takes place over generations, right? So you're watching how these families come to America and then, you know, develop over time. And the major plot point in the film is it's Thanksgiving dinner, and the other, you know, half of the family lives hours away, right? And they're always late. And so, you know, the turkey's ready. The kids are all going nuts. Everyone's hungry. You know, the other folks are hours late. Finally, the head of the family says, let's just eat, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the other family shows up, and the head of that family is outraged. You know, how could you not have waited for us, right? The whole point is it doesn't matter how long it takes us to get here. You're going to wait, right? Because we're family and we're going to have this dinner together.
Yeah, well, if you're family, you'd maybe try to show up on time.
That's another approach. That leads to a decades-long split between the two halves of the family.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I was thinking of that because of what you're saying. Yeah, you can have these very minor things. And in that case, I thought that worked really well. But I think part of it also relates to my other feeling is, like, I think I would enjoy this more if Sam Raimi had directed it, because who did A Simple Plan, which is also in a small town and all that. But I think Sam Raimi would have taken some of the violence and some of the, you know, practical jokes, you know, again, up to 11, right?
he might have made it a little more intense. I know the movies I've seen by him, I don't recall anything like on the order of Saw, but I do
well,
know
the,
like,
Evil Dead stuff has a lot
of
pretty
Evil Dead stuff. Yeah, there's that thing where they slam a trap door on the demon's head and then his eyeball pops out and flies across the room into somebody's mouth. There.
There's a point where a woman is raped by a tree.
okay. I don't recall that. It's been a while. And then there was Drag Me to Hell, and I don't remember a lot of gore in that. I remember liking the movie. The ending was really dark and amusing, and entirely undeserved. But you know, it was also not entirely deserved either. But I mean, it was that was a fun movie. I should watch that again one of these days. But so yeah, he probably would have gone a little darker with it. Although, again, I don't think anywhere near where, like, the Saw movies go.
Right. So where I kind of come down on the worth watching is, of course, Max von Sydow is great. I've never seen him give a bad performance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like I say, if it had been an hour or these other things we talked about, you know, there was more variety or intensity or whatever in the practical jokes, or even maybe if it took a little longer to understand that he was intentionally making all this happen, right, rather than kind of see exactly what he's doing right from the beginning. But so I just feel like, you know, either make it shorter or add in some complexity to make 2 hours worth it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I come down on that, you know.
That's fair. That's perfectly fair. And I actually, it sounds like you may have enjoyed it a little bit more than I feared you would. I thought you might really just resist it. So just the fact that you don't have completely unkind things to say about it is refreshing to me, I guess. But for me, my view of it is that it's one of those movies for me that I mention them every now and then, where sometimes there's a movie that just pretty much everything in it resonates with me, from not only the story, but like the cinematography, you know, the set design, the people they cast in it, the music. The music, I think, is the original score for this. There was one, you know, it's been a couple of years since I watched this, probably several years, maybe five or more. But there was one point where they're doing a little montage of Mr. Gaunt selling items to different townsfolk. Mm. And there's this classical style music playing in the background, and I'm sort of humming along with it in my head. And I'm thinking, oh, I know this one. What is it? You know, and I'm trying to identify what composer it was. And then I'm like, oh, no, that's just that's the movie score. So I the music is something that I think is extremely well done. And then there is music you will recognize, like Hall of the Mountain King and Schubert's Ave Maria, a couple selections like that are used, I think, very well. And I've seen in another movie since this was made, Ave Maria used for a similar situation where basically it's playing in the background while some awful violence is going on. I couldn't help thinking that they might have swiped it from Needful Things. But so the music, the casting, the setting, the dialogue, of course, I love. There's a lot of those sinister little one-liners and exchanges. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those movies that, for me, I love everything. And Max von Sydow, I think, really, I've seen him in various things, and I think this may be, for me, at least of what I've seen of Max von Sydow so far, this may be his masterwork, so to speak, because he's just such a simultaneously evil guy, and yet there's this, at times he seems to convey this genuine warmth, and yet at other times he conveys this utter ruthlessness. So it's just it's a movie that fascinates me from a lot of different angles. Obviously enjoy it much more than you did, but I'm glad at least you saw some value in it. So that's good enough for me.
You can't win. I've got God on my side.
Well, another film I would suggest, if you haven't seen it, that, you know, does the small town with an evil guy moving things forward, is Blue Velvet.
Oh, it's been a while, but I have seen that a couple times. In fact, I have a little silly anecdote about that, which was, I remember I was in the newspaper class in high school, worked on the school newspaper. And our local newspaper, town newspaper, had these capsule reviews where, like, all the movies that were currently in the theater, they'd have like a page of these little one paragraph mini reviews that you could read. And I think they may have actually had a feature article about Blue Velvet too, but basically what it said was it's good but weird. So I finally got to see it, because this was the VHS era, so I could go to the video store and watch it. And it turned out I thought it was good, but I thought, you know, it really wasn't all that weird. Which is probably not something a lot of people would think about that movie, but
right.
You know, to me it just made sense, you know. I just went along with it. So anyway, yeah, that was a fine movie.
What's his name playing the bad guy where
Dennis
he has
Hopper.
This, with this oxygen mask he keeps having to I think you don't know if it's oxygen or some kind of drug gas or
nitrous
or what.
Oxide or who knows what. Yeah.
and a funny anecdote I remember. David Lynch directed that, and when they cast Dennis Hopper, you know, he insisted, I think, on doing the role, and he told David Lynch, like, I am this character. David Lynch said, well, that's great for the movie, but what about when we go out to dinner?
David Lynch, I enjoy a whole lot of stuff that, off the top of my head, I haven't seen all of his work. I got to watch Inland Empire recently because they just released it not too long ago on Blu-ray, and I enjoyed that. I think the only thing of his that I've been really seriously perplexed by was I saw Eraserhead one time, and I think I might need to see that again one of these days, see if I have any better sense.
Well,
that
was a very bizarre film. I think maybe his first film. And then, do you know, so then he got known for doing Elephant Man. Do you know who hired him to do Elephant Man?
I do not.
Mel Brooks saw Eraserhead and decided he wanted to hire him for Elephant Man.
Look,
and that's what kind of really started his career. It also tells you that Mel Brooks had a, you know, depth or an eye that was, you know, more than just the silliness or whatever you might think.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was a very strange or brave choice, right?
Mel Brooks, I think he's a pretty smart cookie, you know?
Yeah.
Even some of his movies that on the first, like Dracula Dead and Loving It, on the first viewing, I was like, it had its moments, didn't really gel with me all that much. But I've seen it a few times since then, and each time I just like it more. So, you know, there's... Of course, I can forgive a lot of broad humor, you know, if there's a mixture of better humor in there as well. And Mel Brooks always does that, you know. Not every joke lands like you might wish, but the sum total, you know, is usually pretty decent. So
he also started Kyle MacLachlan's career.
Oh, yeah.
Because he got Dune, which was another weird one for him to do. And, you know, people have different feelings about it. But that was maybe Kyle MacLachlan's first movie, but certainly the first movie that he was a major star in. And then he put him in Blue Velvet, and he's now starring in the Fallout series.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and he was in Twin Peaks. He's been in all kinds of David Lynch's stuff. And, Dune, I may have said this before in the podcast, but I think that may be, even though Lynch did take some liberties with the story, like those little sonic guns were just, they came out of nowhere pretty much. But I think Dune, maybe overall, Lynch's Dune may be my favorite version I've seen so far, though I haven't seen part two of the new version, so I don't know. I think I'll like part two, but I don't think it'll change that I like the Lynch version best. We'll see.
I was not as impressed with the first one as others were. I actually liked Villanueva. I liked Blade Runner 2049 much more than I expected to.
I liked that, too. Now, I didn't like it as much as the original Blade Runner, but I liked it quite a bit.
Right. Yeah, well, the original Blade Runner for me is one of those... I mean, my whole life was spent, you know, watching seven different versions of the film come out.
The director's cut, the final cut. Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, I think it's a brilliant film. It's also a little problematic to watch in certain areas, but overall a brilliant film. And I don't think 2049 is as good as that, but it was way better than I expected.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Dune one, I just had some real writing issues with, and I don't know. There were just things that didn't work for me in it, even though I know he's got a good visual eye and all that. And I know for most people, they really seem to enjoy it.
Yeah. And it's been a while since I watched it, so I might very well watch it again and think, boy, some of this dialogue really is not that great. but the visual style, of course, is the thing that comes to mind to me first when I think of that movie.
And it is a tough book to, you know, to adapt, in part because the thing about Herbert, at least of those books, in my opinion, is they're terribly written. I mean, you know, they, like, in a scene, he'll jump from each person's head to another person's head and do their thoughts and all this. And it's just hard to follow and a lot of bad writing. But his overall vision, you know, the universe he created and everything was so compelling that I think it overcame a lot of the bad writing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but also when you're adapting it, you know, these are very large books. And it's hard to adapt. I mean,
oh, sure.
At least, you know, they didn't try to put it all in one film. Okay, well,
we've talked about everything but needful things for the last 10 minutes or so, but that's all right.
Maybe some of this will go in the end. We'll see. Well, I think people can make their own decision based on what we said. If you want to see... Obviously, love Max von Sydow and Flash Gordon. I think that's an amazing role.
Oh, yeah.
Very different kind of role for him was Pele the Conqueror, I think was the name of the film. And that's your more sort of traditional foreign film, you know, lots of pathos and all that. But he does an amazing job in it.
You fool!